When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So I guess maybe we could start off by you briefly introducing yourself and then describing the origin of this project, like what got you thinking and critiquing chronology's role in historical thinking.
So by training, I'm an historian of modern Japan. And my first two books are on Japanese history. The first one is called Japan's Orient. And the subtitle, I'll come back to it, is Rendering Past into History. And then the second book is New Times in Modern Japan. So in a sense, I've always been thinking about, as a historian of modern Japan, the problem of history and how people use past in writing history. And in both books, it was very clear that there's a political purpose in writing those histories. And what I found, though, in writing those books is what I thought I was doing, which is to try and unpack how we think about history of modern Japan, or and how history is used, didn't happen. And instead, I mean, even though the books have been, fairly successful for Japanese history books, I always felt like it was often being read within what I thought I was criticizing. And so then, I actually describe, and this is leading up to why history without chronology, I actually describe New Times in Modern Japan, or critique of the first book, because what I didn't do in the first book, because it's written within the complete idiom of history without even thinking about time and temporality whatsoever. And so New Times in Modern Japan was trying to think about more specifically about how time functions in the transformation from one time system to another, and the writing of how that connects to what becomes the national culture of Japan. And then after I wrote that, I realized that I still, especially in reading the reviews, I didn't accomplish the kinds of thinking that I was hoping to accomplish. There was one undergraduate who came up to me after a talk, and she very meekly said, "Well, you said you're criticizing your book and for not doing these things, and I thought you were doing this, which was trying to present a different way of thinking about the history of Japan." And I was just dumbfounded. I had this kind of shocked look on my face, and she just looked at me and she said, "Am I wrong?" I said, "No, you're absolutely right, but you're the only person who has said this to me, among all of the academics and all of the specialists who read it, et cetera, et cetera." So then I began to think, that and I increasingly, time and past were always consistent, constant throughout my research. And then I realized that I had to unpack those. And I started doing a lot of reading on time and temporality. And then that led me to the conclusion that chronological time is the problem that kept me within the field of history, even though I was trying to critique certain parts about that history. So History Without Chronology was an attempt of me trying to work out why it is that we are trapped. And so that's where I kind of remain today. I'm trying to write now on kind of the so what question. So if we have, if Stefan Tanaka is right, and of course I'm always right, right? All academics think that we're right. But you know, I'm just being facetious, but there's a lot of people who now recognize that the time system that we're using, which is connected to the Enlightenment, is decreasingly appropriate or apposite for today's worlds. And there's a lot of, we could cite a whole bunch of different work on that. So it's not that I'm, you know, unique here. But then, so what happens to history, and is it less important or is it more important? By thinking about history using multiple times and problematizing the chronological structure that we use. And I would argue that history then becomes a lot of fun and much more interesting and liberating by opening it up. Now, opening it up also raises questions of certainty, right?
Right, yeah.
But my reaction to that is that, look, man, is there any certainty in the world today that this kind of world history structure has given us? And we think of the major problems of the world, and they're all connected to chronological forms of thinking about how the world and human societies operate. To me, that's a huge amount of uncertainty. Even though we use that, then try and solve the problems that it creates itself. So, it goes back to, and this is why I mentioned the subtitle, highlighted subtitle of Japan's Orient, is I'm still thinking about this. What is the relationship between the past or pasts and history, the writing of history?
Yeah, the plurality there.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I just finished a paper. I called it "What Can Pasts Do?" Or the past as plural, and thinking about then that if we have a notion of multiple times, which is part of the argument of history without chronology, if we have multiple times, then we have to think about different ways that they interact and what they do. And the inputs and the outputs, the connections, the influences are much more varied and specific to the moment. Well, that to me is how my life operates. My life doesn't operate according to the historical structure that historians have created about history. So what I'm doing now is I'm trying to figure out, you know, can I write examples or the so what questions about a history without chronology?
Right. I feel like there's so much there that we could go off of. I guess I'm kind of curious as to what you mean by like how that impacts your personal experience. Like what do you mean by like how you experience time?
Well, So one way is that, and if you think about the methodology of history, the methodology of history is built upon a distrust of individual experience. Even though we talk about writing about experience, historians, the we. And the distrust of experience is that, well, we have to find out ways that event and what that person says is what really happened.
Right. Yeah.
An experience is subjective. And somehow we have to find some way to kind of ground that or kind of understand that subjectivity as a good representation of, I hate to say the word objective, I'm trying to avoid that one. And so much of history is built upon the minimization of human variability. And that's what leads to the separation of history from people's experience. So people will say, I really enjoy reading about this person's life or that person's life, but I don't have a history like that. As if it's not important enough, therefore, or it's not verifiable through documents, therefore it's not an important part of the past that has significance to a whole bunch of people's lives, right? And maybe communities. So there's that part of experience. And then, there's the part of experience where my shorthand way of saying it is that my career is linear and historical. My life as I live it is chaotic and complex. And I don't think very many people would disagree with me if they think about, their own life. But why does history have to separate itself from that kind of complexity that constitutes our lives? And so that's what I mean. And finally, in teaching, I've taught for over 30, almost 40 years. And originally I would teach large lectures. I'd go in there and I'd give these quote unquote brilliant lectures and whatnot. And I thought they were well crafted lectures and with lots of good information and interpretation, nada, nada, nada. I also recognized that what my students remembered after the class was not necessarily what I lectured on. They might have remembered something that happened in the class that was a certain kind of moment, or that I dressed funny one day, or did something, or they might have remembered an off the cuff statement. But rarely do they learn and remember the stuff of the history that you're teaching. So then I decide, and I've been at the latter part of my career, I started working with people who actually know pedagogy. that's the it's not a secret of academic teaching, is that most of us were never trained how to teach or what good methods are.
Right.
I started I stopped lecturing. And the class that I actually liked the most in terms of teaching historical material was a class that I use where I used, I call them comic books, but they're really manga. Like Mizuki Shigeru's History of Showa. It's a four-volume set. And I have the students read that and then come in and ask questions about that. Did this really happen? What did you think about this? What is the connection between what he's writing here, his experience? And he went to war, or he went to Papua New Guinea. And so you could bring in the war, the fighting, the strategy. You could bring in all of the history events. But they're reading it through the lens of Mizuki as a grunt soldier or the citizen trying to, every so often this thing would happen in the news and it might affect his home life or something. And so it inverted it. But what it did is it gave students kind of a mnemonic upon which then they could attach different kinds of historical moments. And I always felt that they learned history better, even through the comic and the discussions that we would have about, you know, why this is historical, than on than when I gave the lecture itself. Even though I might have said the same thing, the way that they experienced the material gave them a different kind of, several different ways to hang on to, or gave meaning to that material. So that's experience in a different sense. And that's where I think history can be a lot more fun and interesting if, you know, you teach it using a variety of materials, you know. You know, for example, I mean, I think John Lewis's, I don't know if you've seen John Lewis's trilogy, The March. It's about his experience in the civil rights movement. You know, I just think it's a terrific way to get students engaged in the civil rights movement through the eyes of, I mean, you know, unfortunately he's now passed away, but of this congressman who, when he was young, he was an activist, and you know, there are different kinds of life events that have more meaning to for the students today than getting up there and lecturing on why the civil rights movement, key events of the civil rights movement. Now, you know, this is not the only way to do it, and you can only do it in certain kinds of occasions. But it's a way of recognizing that perspective, experience, are central parts of understanding the past and its significance to us today, rather than pretending that perspective doesn't make any difference. And so, you know, that's... experience is an interesting thing, hard to get a grasp at, but I've been heavily influenced by, and this is a serendipity of a career. It is in the early part of my career, I encountered this movement of people who were engaged in what then was called cultural psychology. And it was basically bringing culture to psychology, because psychology was basically just a bunch of clinical studies about the middle class American college student, quite frankly. It still remains important to me because the people who did it, and these were Mike Cole, who was my colleague here at UCSD, but I happened to meet him before when I was at a different place. Jim Wirch, we were at Clark together, and he was here at San Diego, and then I came to San Diego. So there's this really interesting connections. But they worked from this Russian psychologist into what's now called situated learning or situated practices. I mean, and it's filtering its way into some complex systems theory in different ways. But it's a recognition that learning involves different kind of levels of scaffolding. And you could present this brilliant book to people, but they're going to, as they read it, they're going to pick up what is familiar to them. And they're not going to pick up what is unfamiliar, which might be, as far as the author is concerned, the most important parts. So that's a stupid thing that I did. Stupid because it was, well, I wrote my second book thinking that you know, people get the most out of it if they read it twice. Now, that's really stupid, thinking that somebody's going to read a book twice, right? You're lucky to get somebody to read a book once.
Yeah.
But I wrote it thinking that, you know, okay, what I'm trying to do is come up with a different kind of conceptual structure And then that could set the scaffold for a different kind than an argument that has a little bit more depth and explanation.
Well, I feel like there's something to say there about like the form of the thing that you're trying to make. I mean, a point that you make in your book is that like there's an impact, like this is more towards the end, like there's like the media or like how you're telling history like can really change how you understand history and time. So it sounds like that's kind of like what you were doing with flipping how you were lecturing and using like a comic book instead, like this, like that change of form and like using a story rather than, you know, lecturing about like dates and places,
right,
really made an impact on like how your students were, you know, engaging with history.
Right. Yeah, no, it's you know, and this gets us into the digital, in the digital age.
Yeah, I was going to have it. Yeah, I had a question about like how does like the digital age like change or makes us reconsider our relationship to history? Yeah, that'd be a good talk about.
But so one is that, you know, I became an historian when I discovered I did not have to memorize names, dates, and places. and that you could become
that's
a professional.
That's what kept me from really enjoying history.
Well, that's the stereotype, right?
The concept of like feeling like I need to learn that, right? Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I would argue that names, dates, and places are very often important, but they're not why history is interesting, and they're not why history is important.
Right. It's like times tables for math.
Excuse me.
It's like, it's good to know, but it's like learning your times tables for math. It's like, you should know them, but it's not, you know, that's not the fun part.
Yeah. It's important for people to know, like, especially today, you know, where different parts of the Middle East are. I mean, they don't have to know that the exact places are. It is important to know, you know, within decades of what happened, whether one thing happened before,
right,
or after another or something like that. But memorizing the date as if therefore you know is a different level of expectation, right? One's a matter of, like the times table, it's a matter of location and having some kind of basis. But the other one then is, well, it's important for all these other reasons of what you can do with it rather than just that you know it. And so history then, when I learned that history, you know, is interpretation. And by studying Japan, I mean, there's two ways to study Japan as far as I'm concerned. One is to accept Japan as the exotic of the Far East, of the Orient, and things like that, which it is. Or you could study Japan as a place having that has all sorts of issues in trying to negotiate its interaction with a broader world, which throughout the 19th and 20th century had been and still is hegemonic. And by hegemonic here, I'm talking about Western civ, imperialism, colonialism, and all these other things. But then you could see that history, and this is, you know, Japan's Orient in New Times, history is critical to trying to negotiate those positions. But when you recognize that utility of history, it's not so much that it's factual, but it's used for specific reasons at specific times. I mean, this is like Putin saying that Ukraine was never independent of Russia. I mean, Russia now has a history where Ukraine was always a part of Russia. Well, you know, that has a politics and perspective along that line. We could find the same kinds of issues going on in the Middle East right now. At least in the news today, they're talking more about the past prior to the Hamas invasion, rather than the Hamas invasion as the explosion of everything, which it was. But there's also more.
Mm-hmm.
And increasingly, the more prolonged it gets, people are beginning to recognize the complexity and the possibility and the dangers of history and interpretation and perspective. But that's why it's so important. And that's why, that's also why I find it so fun to recognize that. But anyway. We're in a society now where, and this is true in the profession too, where I feel like the profession, despite protestation to the otherwise, is still wants to hold on to some kind of notion of certainty and truth.
Right. That kind of gets me to a question of like, maybe backing up a little bit, is like how history has like merged with like that idea of chronology and how that's like limited historical thinking. It sounds like you're getting at it a little bit there.
Well, I mean, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's simple. but you know, the attempt during the Enlightenment to find the universal truth, to find the kind of the holy grail of how all the world is connected. The possibility of creating a knowledge system of everything went along with then this idea that history is a way to organize the variability of the different places in the world. And simple being, Hegel came up with the world history, and as much as we deny, I say Hegel's not important anymore, well, we still operate within a structure of world history. We've changed the words, we don't use the word Oriental anymore, but Asia is often the synonym for it. We still use some version of the primitive in language like the third world, and now we call it the developing world. Well, sometimes the developing world is in some areas more developed than the developed world, right? Their social system or their conceptual system will handle problems in different ways that might be just as, if not more sophisticated than our rational modern worlds. I mean, so it doesn't mean that ordering system needs to say, but that's where chronological time has merged with history, or how history then became a part of that chronology. But that history is hierarchical, and it's hierarchical. The first Gulf War. I mean, we're gonna help them become we're gonna democratize them. I mean, gosh, the idea that all cultures will become like us,
right,
or should become like us, and the chutzpah of that, and just kind of the conceit of that, is just absolutely remarkable. But that's history in combination with chronology, and the other thing about chronology that is important here is that the Newtonian notion of time is based upon physics of the movement of a mass that's altered by some input, and that leads to change. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that kind of notion of movement have to do with how human societies operate? None whatsoever, right? I mean, we're biological organisms. Our societies are different kinds of quite complex organisms of some sort, social organisms, and so we use a metric for of physics to try and understand and control organic systems. It just doesn't work. I mean, if you were to say today, I mean, what's your background in you say, in science? Are you in biology or in the physical sciences?
Yeah, I studied biochemistry and math.
Okay, well, you know, so you're both of it, and you probably have different questions at the same time. I mean, why do we use this formula to study this thing when we're always having to readjust it for this and that and kind of thing? If we had to create a kind of metric for society today, would we use Newtonian physics? I really doubt that we would, because it's so ontologically, quite frankly, it's just so alien to the biological organic systems. But that's what we use. And that makes it into a technocratic metric, because everything has to be measured, right? And that measurement is again, mechanical and objectivistic, right, et cetera. So, you know, the science of the use of chronological time was wonderful for the 19th century, because it led to different kinds of organizations, different ways of thinking about things. And in the 20th century is the fruits of that labor, whereas the other things that it led to were what? Exploration, imperialism, colonialism, and wars.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, here we are again.
Kind of being stuck in a place of using power to reinforce like a certain narrative or like a certain type of thinking. But I mean, kind of getting to the science behind that, or that, you know, is tied along with those like social cultural movements of the Enlightenment and kind of how we're stuck there.
Right.
Like you also note that, you know, like relativity and thermodynamics and quantum mechanics, like they don't work under those systems. Like it's a completely different type of time and of science, really, that like really alters how people think about really a lot of things. You know, like a lot of philosophy has changed under the, like, knowing that quantum mechanics can cause uncertainty and there can be like two things in two places at the same time. So I guess I'm just kind of wondering like how those scientific findings have influenced how we think about time, and like if there is like sort of like a paradigm shift happening in other fields like history.
I hope there is, but I'm skeptical. One of the things that one of the reactions I have heard from various places about my work and my book is, you know, aren't you exaggerating the limitations of history? And you know, don't you have a straw man here rather than what historians actually do? My response to it is, well, you need to separate the structure within which historians are operating and the intent of historians. And so then they would ask, well, what are some examples of books that are critical but still fall within what the system itself? That's why I started with Japan's Orient and New Times, is, you know, when they were published, they were relatively important books and have been more or less the better books in Japanese history, modern Japanese history. But I see them as a failure, not as the failure to write a good history book, but a failure into accomplishing the kind of critique of history that I had intended. And that's where I think a lot of us have fallen back into, where, you know, we're trying to critique history using the structure of history itself. And that's why history of chronology is an attempt to say, okay, you know, this structure has built-in limitations and biases that we have to recognize. And the talk I just gave a couple months ago, a couple people questioned me about, well, you know, I think you're arguing that historian, you know, what you're arguing for historians already do. And I said, you know, my reaction to that was just, well, they're trying to do it, but they're not getting to what, quite frankly, are the fundamental problems. And another word that I don't like using for because of it's overused, but it's the epistemology. Is we have to think of how our knowledge system itself is part of the problem now, rather than operating within the problem system to kind of correct things within it.
Right. So I guess maybe that kind of ties into like a question or like a kind of like how we started before we started recording was talking about that like Certeau. I don't know how to pronounce it. That's right, like Certeau. How you pronounce his name.
Michel de Certeau.
Certeau. And how he has this, or you quote this line about mystics and how they're sort of, I don't have the quote written down, but it's something about like how they reorganize places, or they like create this reorganization of a structure for people to communicate in like the breakdown of a system or something like that. And I feel like that's kind of like what you're calling for, is for this shift in the structure of how to communicate, I guess in this case, history, but I think just like any scholarly communication probably likely has limitations and needs critiqued if it's, you know, using this perhaps outdated system of like chronological time in terms of ordering everything. So I guess I'm kind of wondering, how can historians or scholars or society and academia like create these shifts without like, you know, having a total collapse, like you mentioned earlier about people like wanting certainty. And like there's, you know, I think there's something there that maybe because I'm a scientist too, that like, it's just nice to have, but like, so like, how do you like really create that shift from like knowing that you're not operating in the perfect or like most optimal way, like creating that bridge towards something that's like more effective or more like appropriate for like what you're studying?
I wish I could give you a good answer for that. But that goes back to my response that we know more and more problems we understand are emerging because our ways of understanding how things work are far more incomplete than we've recognized, or that I don't want to say they're wrong, but they're so reductive that it gives a false sense of certainty, quite frankly.
Right, you call that like a mythology. I think a few times in the book you refer to that as like a mask or a myth.
To me, it is. It absolutely is, and it's the idea that climate change, we know it's happening. I mean, the science is pretty clear, but at all sorts of different levels, the social, political, and cultural willingness to deal with it is variable, I guess is the best possible word. I just read in the paper where all the countries that have supported the limitation of warming to 1.5 degrees are now expanding drilling. You know, great news, right? it's the kind of disconnect. I mean, these are not technological problems, but these are problems of a calculus but it's a calculus where we don't recognize that there's a different process set off by the drilling and use of petrochemicals for all these different purposes that has an effect, but it's not an effect that's immediately measurable as our economic system allows it to be or requires it to be. But we now know that the effect is huge. It's a cultural problem. It's a cultural and conceptual problem. It's not a technological problem. So, but what do? We go back to the technology and we just try and avoid these problems. So, that's a hard thing to do. But my answer to your question is that, the first step is to admit it, to recognize the limitations of our epistemology, in my specific case, on the way that chronological time has given us a very particular way of understanding the relationships of different places and how they interact. And those different places don't have to be nation states, but that's the one we use. And how they interact doesn't have to be measured by economic power, extraction of natural resources. I mean, they could be measured by all sorts of different things. To me, a lot of it is to bring those different things back to the table to be discussed rather than to say, well, that's just a cultural problem. Well, the bad news is just the cultural problems are really, really difficult nut to crack, right? And to me, I don't want to disparage scientists, I just cringe every time they say, well, it's a cultural problem. And I think, yeah, but that's why it's so important. That's why you have to consider these other things, because no matter what you do, if you don't consider that the cultural side of it, you could build these things and you're going to end up with a Newton, the Apple Newton or something, rather than, something that's more successful.
I feel like that kind of gets back to like what we were talking about a little bit before we were recording about like the issues of scholarly publishing and how it's like really challenging to create shifts towards like more open and equitable and sustainable publishing practices. It's just like people, when they're publishing academic texts, like they weren't thinking about culture and they weren't thinking about these other things. They were thinking about certain metrics like citations and certain metrics like, they're just so focused on like presenting the things that they found that they weren't thinking about, how to build like social infrastructure around that thing to, make it applicable.
Right.
Year after year, decade after decade, or even further. And something that you also said there, I hadn't thought about this until just now, about just like how having a different conception of time doesn't like changes how we think about and how probably we like perform historical thinking, but also like how we interact with the future. You're talking about climate change.
Right. No, it's. History is all about trying to make smart decisions for the present. And that present is always the future, or was the future, right? In a sense.
Right.
Even though it's not the distant future, it's always, there's always a level of anticipation in there. That's to me, that's why history is so important, is to recognize that history is not just about this dead past of nation states and famous, mm-hmm. Thankfully, we're no longer just doing famous men. Even famous, women. I mean, so many people have done important things that have gone unrecognized. And we're always trying to recognize those who have been unrecognized. But can't we build a different understanding where we don't have that kind of juxtaposition of important and unimportant. But, you know, every act is meaningful, but at a certain level. In some cases, a meaningless act becomes meaningful because of certain kinds of interactions that take place. And vice versa, right? You know, a lot of things that we predict are going to be, you know, huge events turn out to be nothing, for example. And that's, to me, that requires us to think about the full past rather than the historical past. And that's why I use the plural past rather than mm-hmm. the past. And for when you're teaching, you think about, you think about learning, all of our decisions about or how we learn embeds and builds upon what we've learned before.
Right.
And mm-hmm. that's both historical as well as experience, as well as kind of memories, and mm-hmm. all jumbled together. So why do we separate them? Or I shouldn't say why do we separate them, but why do we distinguish one as more important than another?
Right.
You know, they interact. And in that sense, to me, if you teach, if you allow people to understand that learning occurs variably, people see different things of the same event. You know, and these are all proven psychological. There's the gorilla. You've heard about the gorilla, kind of entering the room.
Right.
And it's amazing that it's replicated, and it's, even though people know it, it still happens.
Right.
There's something there. But, when people understand that, then it leads to, you're right, I'm wrong. But, how come you came to this conclusion? What about this conclusion? I mean, you have to have a little bit more of a discussion about the variation that exists, right? To me, that's a goal of a democratic system, quite frankly.
Right, yeah.
But getting people to recognize, there was another article in the paper where, humanities departments or kind of divisions are yet again under the acts in different states. The idea that these are window dressing kind of fields. It's not essential mm-hmm. to the functioning of a vibrant society. It just blows my mind. I mean, it's not the world that I grew up in. It's not my profession. You just look out there and it's clear that we have to think about other ways of thinking about right and wrong, and move towards different levels of variation and perspective. So the things that I'm trying to do now are things like, how can history be, another word that I don't like using, better, but how could history be something that people recognize as being of a greater utility at all mm-hmm. sorts of different levels mm-hmm. in their lives and in our societies. But that requires history to be more than what history, the discipline is. So comic books using different kinds of imagery of, texts, different narratives, storytellings come back, which is a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these things are starting to happen in some levels, but when I talk about, I left the part about, I really cut short the stuff on comics in my talk off. But that was the part that I wanted. I really, it raises questions about learning and knowing. and it raises questions about the need, and this is getting back to, again, the digital, but, you know, in the digital age, we're no longer in the textual age, in the digital age. And, you know, we're engaged on this kind of conversation now, which if you just do a transcript of the talk, I mean, my talk's going to be kind of, well, it's going to be bad. But with your good editing or whatever, you know, it'll sound somewhat coherent. But, you know, the good thing about that is you recognize that people have, as they're talking, you know, they're processing at the same time, right? And not everything is prepared and neat and tidy and whatnot. That's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely my favorite part about these conversations is just like, yeah, just getting to, you know, discuss the ideas like on the fly and really dive deep in some of the topics. But I think maybe this is a good place to end, because you kind of mentioned like the positive parts of where you see history going in terms of including more storytelling and different types of digital media. But I guess I'm also kind of curious as to why, given that, given your appreciation for those types of historical communication, like why did you choose to do like a long form text for History Without Chronology? Or do you have like other projects that are like non-text versions for your future critiques of history?
So, History Without Chronology. I think there's a paragraph in the introduction. History Without Chronology started, from me engaging in a digital project, and you could, I think it's still up. It's 1884.ucsd.edu. 1884, just the numbers, the year, .ucsd.edu. And what I was trying to do was trying to think about tearing apart history. And history is data, categories, and interpretation. And then see how then we could arrange them in different ways. And so then history could be read in different ways. And there's no such thing as a short and easy digital project. So I thought, I'll spend 6 or 12 months on this, and I'll get something done, and I'll be back to my real work. Well, you know, it's still there, and there's one thing I discovered, and this is also what led me into scholarly communications. I've participated in, and I've actually directed a lab. It's kind of a psychology lab. But I'm not a good collaborative lab kind of operator who builds projects and teams. I'm trained as an iconoclast. And, you know, learning collaboration is learning collaboration. You know, you just don't collaborate and do it well. Because we're all good at this, or we're all human and social. And so part of the problem was, I couldn't build the project. I ran into technological problems. I was trying to get, I wanted a non-relational database. And when I talked to people about it, you know, I would either get questions like, why? Because relational databases, you have to define your categories before you build it, right? I mean, that's the beginning of doing a database. But that's the problem of history, is if you predefine your categories, you've already determined what your answers are.
Yep.
And then so when people understood what I wanted to do, you know, I got one response, which was, well, that's too hard. I mean, and it is hard because, you know, it's with computing power, it's probably not necessary anymore. But I wanted to be able to manipulate the categories based upon the data that's in there. Now you could just do an n-gram or a word-gram or a Wordle, and you could pretty much get the stuff that I wanted out of it. But so I ran into those kind of technical problems. And I also ran into problems of grantmanships. So I would write grant proposals that I would get to like the NEH.
Right.
And my grades were usually A and an F. You know, conceptually, this is great. This is new. We haven't seen anything like this before. We should do it. Technologically, there's nothing new here. Well, that's exactly right. But because you're getting technologists to also do us, they were looking for the new and the greatest and everything like that. So there's that. And then, I'd love to write a comic book, a historical comic book. But I can't write the comic book. It's a collaborative project of finding the right kind of artist and I don't even know if I could do the storyboarding, because it's a different kind of writing. So this is a very long-winded way of saying that history of chronology, the interesting thing about history without chronology is that it's an arguing for it's a book arguing for history in a different kind of conceptual structure.
Yeah, a manifesto.
Okay. But it's written in the format that you're trying to move away from. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's that's certainly one of the limitations of it. And I had hoped that this is the other part about the digital, which is, for the longest time, and you've been there for a long time, but and you alluded to this, you build the tool and then people will see its value and they'll come and start using it. It doesn't work that way in academia. And so when the book was published, I was hoping that we built a hypothesis engine on it, and so people could just kind of comment on it, and then my hope was that in about 5 years the comment stream would be both corrective and addition to what I wrote. And so then there would be HWC 2.0, which is independent of what I wrote, or independent of me, but is based upon 1.0. Mm-hmm. Now, that again is like my idea of writing a book to be read twice. It depends upon somebody reading the book and then taking the time to comment on these things.
Right.
Which doesn't happen.
Well, maybe the release of this podcast will bring more people to do that.
Well, I hope so.
Well, we'll put links down below, and everyone will do it, or at least they'll check it out. Maybe they'll feel compelled to engage.
Well, I hope so. The potential is there.
Right.
But when I stopped actively doing scholarly communications meetings and work, I concluded then that what we need is a series of mandates and carrots. And we've not done the mandates well at all. And the mandates have to be from academic organizations and university and promotion and tenure decisions.
Yeah, promotion and tenure is big. I mean, at least the there's like that Nelson memo that came out last year that's like mandating that scholarly research, publicly funded scholarly research, needs to be open access by, I can't remember what year, but I think that's definitely a big push in the US, at least, to get more things open. But yeah, what that looks like, it might just be more static PDFs, which would be
Yeah, yeah. But even that would be an advantage.
Thank you for taking the time to, you know, talk with me about your book and, you know, everything else that we ended up talking about as well.
Well, thank you, Sarah.